I've always been an independent DIY kind of musician. For me, it's great, and I welcome it. But it is hard, you know. It's easier to distribute your music too. And again, it's hard to market it because it's so much noise and so much things you got to cut through. So, and you know, the big labels are starting to control the streaming. They're making special deals with Spotify and YouTube, and they're starting to control that bandwidth. And it's going to get harder and harder, as always, for independent musicians because there's, you know, no one's making money off of us. We're making all of our own money. So it's always going to be that struggle between the corporations and the independent people.
Singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Kevin Russell joins John and Scoop in this episode of the Plutopia Podcast. Kevin talks about his days with the Gourds and his current band, Shiny Ribs. We also talk about violence in music venues, streaming music, COVID's impact on the music business, and a possible Gourds reunion. Stick around for the end of our session. Kevin plays a bit and talks about guitars.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Plutopia News Network. Yet another podcast episode. And our guest today is Kev Russell. Kevin Russell, who's a singer, songwriter, a multi-instrumentalist, plays guitar, mandolin, and banjo, and who knows what else. Formerly of the Gourds, and currently the fearless leader of the band Shiny Ribs. And that was actually, it's the band now, but they just called you Shiny Ribs originally, right?
Yeah, it's called, create a lot of confusion, you know, but confusion is my forte.
We like confusion here. Chaos.
Yes, I know you do. I know you do.
They just go together.
Yeah. Good things come out of confusion, chaos, like the universe.
So, I mean, kind of, when did you start playing? When did you start writing songs? You've been doing that a long time, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, I'm literally living my dream. I dreamed of it when I was probably about 7 years old. But ever since I can remember, really, my dad played guitar and sang, not professionally, but just around the house and campfires and stuff, and so I always thought that was cool, and wanted to be like Dad, be like Joe. And I was always trying to talk my friends into learning instruments and we could start our own band. And I did the ubiquitous broomstick in front of the mirror playing with Beatles songs or whatever, you know, too. Before I was about 14 when my dad finally, my mom put him up to it. She told him to get, she thought I would probably like to learn the guitar. So he came in, asked me if I wanted to learn how to play. And I was like, yeah, sure. So he gave me a Mel Bay chord book and this folk song book. I couldn't read music. He couldn't read music, but it had all the music in there and the lyrics and the chords. So, so that's what I did. I would learn chords and I would look at these songs. Like at the time, Old Brown Shoe, I had never heard Old Brown Shoe, but it was in there. And so I would just look at the chords and the lyrics and make up my own melody to the play the chords in order in the lyrics. And that's kind of what got me set on the course of writing songs. I always wanted to be a songwriter. I just thought that was a cool idea. I always liked poetry. You know, my mom turned me on to poetry when I was a kid. Albeit not some, not a lot of great poetry, but like Rod McEwen and Leonard Nimoy, stuff like that.
Oh,
but
I remember liked, that stuff.
You know, yeah, yeah. She liked that stuff, and I liked it too, you know. So I got it, you know, the idea of writing in time, meter, and I associated that with songs. It made sense to me that songs are just poetry, you know, put to music, so. That was my dream as a kid, and man, I'm still doing it today.
I heard a rumor that you almost went into the book industry.
Mm-hmm. I did. Well, I did work at bookstores for a long time.
Yeah, down at Book People?
Yeah, Book People, yeah. I was down there for, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 years probably. I helped them move from Brody Oaks to the 6th and Lamar location, and I was the receiving manager. And so I was working in the back there, just checking in books and returning books. You know, it was, my life was full of with cardboards and pallets and styrofoam peanuts.
I worked with Phil Sansone at one time trying to build an online bookstore when we were doing hopepeople.com.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was kind of fun to work with.
Yeah, he's a character. I used to mess with him a lot. Everyone was afraid of him, but I thought he was kind of a cool guy, you know, and he could take, he had thick skin, you know, he could take a joke.
Yeah, that was kind of fun back then. You know, there was originally that was Grok Books.
That's right, Grok.
And my company at one time moved into this building, and I realized that we had moved into the ground floor of the old Grok Books.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah, right over there. I guess Oat Willie's had turned into, I guess, Mars Cafe or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Downtown.
Uh-huh. Where exactly was, Grok exactly? I can't remember exactly.
Grok was on, I think it's 17th Street.
Okay.
It was just a little bit west of Guadalupe, I think.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I can't remember the exact address of that place, but it was a pretty good pretty good office, pretty centrally located.
Mm-hmm.
So,
But music took over, you know, eventually. Music was always my passion, so.
And I'm sure your parents were real excited that you were getting into music, right?
Oh, yeah, they were. You know, they wanted me to go to college, but they love music. And they didn't think I would be able to make a living at it, of course. And they were worried about my future and blah, blah, blah. But I wasn't. I already figured out I was going to be a rock star. So I don't know what they had to worry about.
Did you start with a garage band, typical garage band kind of thing?
Mm, yeah. So Beaumont, I started playing. I lived in Beaumont, was born there and lived there till I was about 14, 15. About the time I started playing guitar and writing songs, we moved to right outside of Houston. It's like Humble, Lake Houston, kind of suburbs of Houston. That was the big oil boom in Texas, you remember. And my dad was working for an oil supply company, and he was doing their computers, their inventory systems. He was programming computers. Taught himself how to do it. And I remember back then the computer was the size of a giant room, you know, and he'd take us to work with him. And you know, at night he'd be doing stuff and he'd print out these big giant pieces of green and white paper. You remember those little spools?
Oh, I remember, yeah.
And it'd be like XO picture of like Snoopy. And we were like, wow, amazing. And it would take like, you know, an hour to print out. But so he was doing that kind of work and doing really good, and the industry was booming. So his, you know, they did like diamond drill bits and hardware for oil wells and things like that was what his company did. And so we moved to this posh country club neighborhood, which might's when my class consciousness was raised. I moved from a, you know, working class neighborhood in Beaumont to country club community outside of Houston in the early 80s, and that really sort of instilled in me music was my outlet. I just focused on music at that point, and it was good for me because I had a lot of angst and I was real frustrated about being taken out of my home, right, my hometown, and put into this nightmarish place. But eventually I did meet some guys and they played music too, and we started a garage band. We had a lot of names. It seemed like every week we'd have a different name. But the one name we used for the one gig we played, name of the band was Malice.
That's a great name.
It was pretty good. It was pretty good, Malice.
Were you playing like doomy sort of stuff? Like
no, it was just sort of my original songs, and which were pretty elementary and poppy and, you know, nothing.
Yeah, a name like that sounds like death metal or hardcore.
The name belied our style, actually. The one gig we played, it was on Valentine's. I was still in middle school. I was in eighth grade. And it was the Valentine's Dance. And we were really good at promoting ourselves, apparently, because everyone was talking about Malice. And they were going to play the show. And all of our friends were there. The gymnasium was packed. Of course, we didn't know the first thing about what you needed to play a show. We were just like, yeah, we'll play a show. So we show up. I had this giant casino amp, like from the freaking 60s, you know. It was like 10, 12 inch speakers. It was loud as hell. And my friend played, he played drums. And then we had a bass player and another guitar player, but they didn't show up. They were afraid. And there was a DJ. And so we got ready to play and we're like, didn't have a microphone or anything, no PA. And so the DJ just sort of rolled his eyes and he said, here, you can use my mic. He gave me his mic and we started playing and that place was cleared. By the second song, it was just so bad. It was a complete failure. Malice. That was the beginning and the end of Malice right there.
Well, the fact that you continued on with the music after that
says
a lot for your stick to it.
Yeah, our parents were very encouraging to us. They, I remember we went to Denny's afterwards and we were really dejected and they just kept patting us on the back and said, hey, it'll get better. It can't get any worse than this. Just think, you can only go up from here.
Or so you hope. You know, you've been doing music a long time. How would you compare the experience of being a musician back then with what it's like today?
Man, it's crazy. You know, I mean, just technology. I used to think about what my grandparents lived through until their end of their life. How much technology transformed the world, but it just hasn't stopped, right? It just keeps getting faster and faster. And in the music industry, for sure. I mean, back then, I mean, we didn't know anything. I mean, I remember my first early days of playing gigs, you had to bring your own PA and you had to play three sets a night. This is in Louisiana when I was living there. You had to play three sets a night, you know, at least sometimes four sets a night, you know, from 10 to 2 in the morning. You know, for a few $100, it was not easy, and it was hard to promote. How do you promote back then? Well, you have to have a mailing list and mail people stuff, and booking gigs. You know, it was long distance calls. You know, I try to explain to my kids. Yeah, it used to cost a lot of money to make a call to the next town. You know,
boy, really,
it was ridiculous. It was a total scam, and I knew it was a scam. I think we all did.
So, did any of your dads like technology prowess rub off on you? Are you kind of a tech guy?
No, I mean, I'm clever and I can figure things out. So maybe so. I don't know if it's, I wouldn't call myself tech savvy, but I am able to figure things out if I think long and hard enough. And keep
you've always had a really good online presence. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's something I was, you know, somebody told me that early on, like that was the key to it. It's just engaging with fans. I'm like, well, I'm always engaged with my fans, you know.
Yeah, I moved to Colorado a few years ago and was really missing the Gourds. And then I found out you had an email list.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's kind of like, I mean, I couldn't hear you play, but I could at least read your words.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The old listserv, the Cucurbitacea.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Those were great days, man. Yeah.
Well, Charlie set that up, didn't he?
You know, I know it was a, God, I can't remember the girl's name. It was a Melinda Hare. She was from Houston, and she set it up for me. Yeah. And she could, you know, she was telling me about Postcard and Postcard 2, the No Depression listservs and how many people were on those, and it sounded cool to me.
Well, your description of what you did to promote, it resonates with me. I've managed bands in the Bay Area for 20 some odd years, and it was in that time, and it was difficult. And
it was difficult. Yeah.
We were just starting to get computers. I started carrying a computer on the road when we were touring, and that was difficult because it was big, and you couldn't find any place to hook it up. But the technology of recording music has really changed. I was there back when we were recording on little eight-track studios, and now it's totally digital.
Yeah.
Do you miss any of that analog?
I mean, you can record analog if you want. You know, it's there. And I love recording analog, especially on nice gear, nice thick, you know, 24-track tape is great, or 16-track. 2-inch tape can sound amazing. And there are places you can do that. You know, like Bruce Robinson has a studio out in Lockhart where it's all analog. It's old school, totally. No digital anything. So, but I don't miss like rewinding the tape, or when you make a mistake, you can't easily go in and fix it, right? You have to maybe sometimes do a whole nother take if it's a bad enough mistake. So there are things I miss about it, but to me, digital really was democratized recording music. In the 80s, we didn't have any money. We were totally broke musicians, and we couldn't afford to go to a studio. It was too expensive, and we couldn't produce CDs. It was too expensive, like, for us, and vinyl, too. We would do live to two-track is the cheapest, easiest way as a little band back then we could do, which is okay, but it wasn't great, you know. So it was hard unless you had somebody with some money, like a record label or something. And now you do have the technology. I mean, it's amazing what you can do now, and it's cheap and it's easy and sounds great. So that excites me. But the flip side of that is every jackass can make a record. So it's a flooded market. It's hard to, there's a lot of noise. It's hard to cut through that.
Yeah, it's made it hard on the studio owners who impacted, because the people that used to come in to record can do it in their bedroom. It doesn't mean it's going to be great, but it's doable.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, so there are, you know, pros and cons of both. I mean, for me, as you know, I've always been an independent DIY kind of musician. For me, it's great, and I welcome it. But it is hard, you know. It's easier to distribute your music too. And again, it's hard to market it because it's so much noise and so much things you got to cut through. So, and you know, the big labels are starting to control the streaming. They're making special deals with Spotify and YouTube, and they're starting to control that bandwidth. And it's going to get harder and harder, as always, for independent musicians, because there's, you know, no one's making money off of us. We're making all of our own money. So it's always going to be that struggle between the corporations and the independent people.
But there's kind of more of an emphasis now on performance as a way to get out there and sort of recruit fans and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You guys do. It's such a great show.
Yeah. That's always been my bread and butter is the performance, is live stuff. You know, that's always been the way an indie music creator is gonna do it. It's, you got to be good at a performance if you want to get anywhere as an indie, I think. But
you're on the road a lot, right?
Yeah, I play all the time. Yeah.
How do you feel about being on the road a lot?
Well, you know, I like it when I'm on the road. Like in the few days before I leave, I sort of dread it. And then I'm on the road and I love it. And then when I get home, I'm really happy to be home. A lot of mixed emotions about it. I mean, like anybody who travels for their work, I'm sure feels, I do love it, but it's not easy, you know, and it does take its toll. And, you know, I'm sort of debating in my head about best way to go forward at my age and this point in my career, you know, just a better balance. I feel like, you know, with my kids, I feel like, I mean, I never missed a birthday, and I was always there for them, but I was gone a lot. And it's kind of funny how now that they're all grown, I'm thinking about maybe I should stop playing so much.
Well, one of the challenges of touring is the expense. And it's really gone through the roof just this year. Gasoline, accommodations, just anything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Everything's more expensive. I mean, hotels were already going up before COVID, you know, it was kind of crazy what was going on. And that the cost of hotels kind of pushed me towards, before I never would have tour buses. I just felt like that was extravagant and I could use that money better because tour buses are expensive and drivers. But the cost of hotels have gone up so much, especially in major markets, that I decided a bus was cheaper, really, and better for me with such a big group of people. So that's what we've been doing. But that's even hard now with COVID, because a lot of bus drivers moved to, because there was nobody touring, they all went into driving trucks and got out of that world. So there's not a lot of drivers right now. And that's the hard part in that regard, is getting reliable, good drivers. So if anybody out there wants to change careers, you could be a tour bus driver. Just go get your CDL.
Yeah, I've known a lot of those guys over the years that had their own tour buses, and mm-hmm. a lot of them had to just cash them in and do yeah. something else because of the strange things that mm-hmm. are happening with you, just the expense of being yeah. of going anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
the other challenge that I've seen for musicians in this area, violence in the entertainment district. And has that changed your outlook on how you prepare for a show, given the things that have been happening lately?
I haven't seen anything like that. I've not experienced any violence where I've been playing. I don't know necessarily. So, I mean, I'm sure it depends on the, you know, it's always been the youth culture. You're going to get more of that because you get more young men and crowded spaces with girls around, and you know how boys are. So I think that's a lot of it, and I think it's always been there. But so I'm not too concerned about it. I haven't experienced any violence, and I mean the only thing that gets sketchy sometimes we pull into some hotels, and you can tell by looking at the place, like this ain't where we want to stay. But other than that, I mean, the venues are fine. The security's there. And most cities I've been in, I haven't felt any issue with that.
So. It's like my mother used to say, you just stay out of the bad neighborhoods. Know where you are. And that's something I would always, you know, I always talk to all my crew guys and musicians, is like, don't assume that just because you're a rock star that people are going to treat you nicely. They may want to mug you, so you have to be aware of where you are and what you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. We are aware, and we're prepared for anything like that. I mean, luckily, we never had a problem with it, but and, you know, there's not a lot of cash changes hands anymore either. Just like the world we live in, you know, it's becoming less and less of a cash world. So there's really not a lot to steal. I mean, our instruments are all insured, and we don't travel with anything too rare or irreplaceable. You know, it's all stuff that can take a beating, and if it does get broken or stolen, it's not the end of the world. You know, we can replace it. So we've thought all that through pretty much.
So how does playing with Shiny Ribs compare, or being Shiny Ribs, compare with working with the Gourds?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, with Shiny Ribs, I am a benevolent dictator. It's really whatever I want to do, I can do. I'm on stage, I'm totally free. And that's kind of what propelled the Shiny Ribs thing, is because the Gourds, God love them all, you know. I mean, and I would not trade that for the world, that experience. But I tell a lot of people, it was like being in a gay five-way marriage, really. It was it was like all of us had veto power, right? And so anything, just go and get something to eat sometimes was like an argument. So it was hard, and it was exhausting after 20 years of it. So by the time, and on stage, you know, there were people in the band who didn't care for my antics, my theatrical things I did. And once I started dancing on stage during the Gourds, you know, that was really frowned upon by some of them, not all of them, but some of them. And that's when I knew, I was like, man, I gotta be free. And so the Shiny Ribs thing, I am free to be me as much as I want to be me. And no one in the band has a problem with it. They like it. They're all for it, you know? So that is a huge difference for me. It's just been great for my mental health and for my my shaking hips.
So, do you think there'll ever be a Gourds reunion?
I do. I do, and I think more and more of it. You know, me and Jimmy are still estranged. We haven't spoken really since the last show, which was October 2013.
A great show.
It was a great show. I'll never forget that show.
Me neither.
It was like a three-hour show, but it felt like 30 minutes. It's crazy. And every face in the crowd, everyone I looked at, there was a story there. I mean, it was like my life was flashing in front of my eyes. and we spoke maybe a couple of times after that. We got the Austin Chronicle Hall of Fame Award, I think, the next year. And we were together then and spoke a little bit. But since then, really, we haven't spoke much. And I've been thinking about him a lot, and I've even had some dreams about him. And so I just feel like I need to reach out to him, and I'm going to reach out to him. So, Jimmy, if you're watching this, expect my call.
Yeah, and I know a lot of us are looking forward to seeing that reunion, though.
Yeah, hopefully.
Nothing really can compare to a Shiny Ribs show.
No, I mean, Shiny Ribs is its own thing, but the Gourds was great, too. You know, people come to the shows, and they want to hear Gourd songs, and I play some in my solo shows, but I don't play them with Shiny Ribs. I never did. Never wanted to, because, the Gourds is a unique thing, and especially even Gin and Juice. Like, I mean, you just can't recreate what we did with that.
Yeah, it's just different band, right?
Different band, different personnel, different feel, so different instrumentation. And I miss those songs too. I've done a couple of shows with Claude Bernard, the accordion player. We did some during COVID. There were a few people that hired us for backyard sort of Gourds parties, and we live streamed some of those, I think. And it was fun, playing those songs with Claude again. I miss him. I mean, he's such a sweetheart, one of the funniest dudes I know. And so I've done it a little bit, and I know it'll be fun when we do it again. And I expect at some point we're going to do it again.
Well, since you mentioned COVID, did COVID have, I know it did. It had a huge impact on your work, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, this whole last record I just put out, Late Night TV Gold, that's what I did during COVID. I just came out here to the studio and I had already, been working with recording software, and I had a good feel for how to do that, but I had to really upgrade my gear and learn a little bit more. And I started using MIDI software so I could use, I could put horn sounds and other instrument sounds into the recordings. And I would just come out here every night pretty much during the lockdown. I was out here all the time for hours and hours, just recording, making music, learning the live stream, and learning to edit video. I was learning all this technology that I would have never, ever had enough time to learn.
Those live streams were actually pretty great.
Yeah, they started out with just me on my phone in here, and I started trying to improve it and learn the best way. And a lot of other musicians helped me, like Betty Sue and Jamie Harris. They helped a lot of people, and I helped a lot of people with, we talked to each other like, well, how do you do this? And how does this work? And, people would call me, other artists would call me. I remember one, Marsha Ball calling me about stuff, and telling her what I did and what I got and upgrading gear to do this and that. And she figured it out too. We all did. And I'm kind of proud of everybody. All the artists I know really have just thrived during this time. Yeah. And that's what we do. It really instilled in me the thought that no matter what happens, I'm going to be fine.
And well, I'm going to do what I do. Now that you've returned to live performance, do you see a continuation of the live streaming for any period of time?
I do, and I'm trying to figure that out. I mean, we were interested in live streaming before lockdown because the technology had just emerged. And we tried live streaming different ways of shows themselves, but the problem was Wi-Fi and Wi-Fi stability and all the different places we were. That was the biggest hurdle, and I think it still is the biggest hurdle to it. Now, if you ever get a consistent Wi-Fi signal that you can rely on, then you could legitimately live stream every show you do. And there may be some acts doing that already, but that's something I'm thinking more and more. I would like to travel with a videographer who could also live stream and capture video and other content, and then do edited videos later too, but also provide live streams of the show. And you want it to be multi-camera as well, so that would have to be automated. One person would have to be able to do it, but you'd have, that's an extra person to travel with. And
yeah, that stuff isn't cheap either.
It ain't cheap. No, it ain't cheap.
But I've seen some artists that have quote unquote live streamed, but it was actually recorded, with professional gear and then fed through their live stream setup. And it was nice quality, but it kind of takes away from that thing of being there in the live.
Right. Yeah, and I get that. I started doing that too. That's why I got into video, because I was like, live streaming is very limited what you can do with it. And I found myself wanting to have different things happen that I couldn't do, and I didn't have any help with the camera in my studio. It was basically me in here by myself. So that's why I was like, well, I got to start editing things and mixing those with my live stream. And I've seen a lot of people do that. You do lose the immediacy of it. And I think audiences feel that too. Somehow they know.
So when did you start playing live again?
I started playing live pretty early on. It was probably, it was June of 2020. I figured out, I was pretty sure that outdoor gigs would be safe. I felt like I was safe outdoors and keep my distance, and it was outdoors and small groups of people, just, it was a little private stuff in people's backyards. So it was bubbles of people who knew each other already, who would hire me to come play. And I was marketing that on social media and did pretty well with it. It was just me and my tour manager, Choppy. I had my own little PA, and we had a little light show, and it was all self-contained. We show up in somebody's backyard and put it all up, do a show, tear it all down, and walk out. And it was pretty cool. So I started doing that in June of 2020 and kept doing that, just solo shows. The band didn't really play a whole lot until I guess it was March of this year. We had a bunch of gigs we had postponed in March of 2020. And so March 21 came around. We were like, we decided we were going to try and do those gigs and start playing again. And they were at Kessler Theater and Heights Theater, which in Dallas and Houston, respectively. And so those theaters, they put in ultraviolet lights, they put in new ventilation systems. They did everything you could do to make their theaters as safe as possible, and low capacity, spread out, tables only, mask required. So we did those shows, and there was 1 week that we made up all those shows, and they were all sold out, but we had to do multiple shows per night because we had to have lower capacities in the room. And it turned out to be, what was it? It was, 2 shows a night for 4 nights. So it was 8 shows over 4 nights, and it was grueling, man. It was grueling, but that really got us back into playing live again.
That sounds like going back to the old, top 40 band, days, three or four sets a night.
It was, it was exactly what it was,
Well, one of the big impacts COVID had on the music business that I saw was the impact on the technical people and the sound companies and lighting companies and the venues. Venues that I used to love, some of them are gone. and they won't be back. And that was the sad part of all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was our biggest concern, among my music community, was, saving as many venues as we could. And, we even went down to the steps of City Hall, you know, and yelled at the City Hall, even though there was no one in it, to release the money, the hotel occupancy tax money that we had all voted on, in 2019. And we knew that money was there, but they just still didn't know how they were going to distribute the money. They never had a plan for it. So, and we said, well, you need to give it to the venues now. You know, we need to keep all of those tech people, the wait staff, everyone employed by those venues, and the venues themselves, we got to keep them alive, because if they go out, there's not going to be anywhere to play when this is over. And there's going to be a whole disaster capitalism movement. They're going to have Live Nation come in and buy it all up. And then we'll be really screwed, you know. So independent music will be screwed.
To see how packed everything is now, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's come back. And, you know, we did lose a lot of venues, but I think we saved – we save a lot of them too. So, and it's picking up. It's starting to pick up. I mean, it's still a struggle. I mean, I've toured all this fall, all around the country. And I mean, everybody reports the same thing. Attendance is not what it was before, but there are people there, and which is good. And the venues are getting money. The bands are working. People are getting music in their life again. So ultimately it's a positive thing. But you're getting hit from both sides still, you know, from people who are still afraid to go out, and then people who are mad that you're asking for proof of vaccination or masks or whatever protocols, who don't want to have to do anything. So you're getting it coming and going. I get a lot of fans who are mad at me about on both sides of the issue. I'm like, man, y'all just gotta understand, we gotta serve everybody. So you gotta compromise so we can just do this. We're just trying to do shows and do what we're put here to do. Y'all just gotta understand, you know, like, but people get mad about it, you know. It's like, well, I'm sorry. We're doing the best we can, man.
Sound like that you would have to have two shows a night, one for the crazy people and one for the people who want to live.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, when we first started playing back in, in the spring, and when vaccines started going, you know, everybody let their guard down a little bit. And then that summer spike happened in July, and that's when I got COVID from a gig. And then it really hit me. I was like, wow. We're going to have proof of vaccination. We're just going to have to do everything we can to keep playing. So I promised my band, because they were afraid to play. And so I had to make a promise to them that we'll do everything we can if y'all just stick with me and we'll figure out a way. And so that's what I've done since. And again, now we're getting to that place again where everybody's starting to let their guard down a little bit. And I'm very wary of this moment. I hope it's going down and it'll just become something we just manage. But I'm keeping our protocols through at least the end of this year, or at least Christmas shows. I just feel like we should stick with what's been working for us. None of us have got sick since then. So
on the one hand, you got a lot of people vaccinated, but on the other hand, a vaccination is not a sure thing, you know. You can still get sick with a vaccination. So
exactly. So, and I know for me it was not a serious thing when I got sick, and I know for most vaccinated people it won't be, but there's no guarantee of that. So, because it's a mysterious thing, we don't know why it affects some people more severely than others. There's no way to know.
It really shows how different people are in their response, in their, like, in their state of health and the way that they respond to things. And that's really, I mean, that's something that I've come to understand more and more, you know, just kind of talking to people about, about talking to physicians, talking to patients, talking to people about healthcare and all of that. And there's an increasing understanding that you can't have a template, you know, people are just different.
Yeah. Everybody's different. Yeah, exactly. There's no way to predict how anyone's going to react to the disease or to the vaccine. You know, really, there's a lot of margin for error there, but
we've learned some shit from this for sure.
Oh man, I tell you. Yeah. And we're still learning. It's going to be a while.
So do you want to play something?
Gosh, I could play something, I guess. Let me see here. Get out of that phone.
That's a great start.
Sounds good to me. We can do a little sound check here.
Yeah.
I noticed that Sasquatch is there with you.
Sasquatch is always here with me.
That's a great shirt.
Yeah. Everybody loves this shirt. I got it. I don't know where I got it. I bought it online. One of my fans, he sent me a link to it. And what can I play? Where am I here? See what's out here. It's got this cool guitar.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah, that's an old guitar. So what is the maker of it? I'd never heard of him. Bonron. It's an 1889. It's an antique here. Somebody refurbished it. I had to get it because I was like, man, I gotta hear what a guitar from the 19th century sounds like. It must have some magic in it, you know. And it does. Oh yeah. Let's see what I do here. Over at Book People in the receiving department over there, there was a young man who worked for me over there named Mark Allen, and he loved music. You know, we used to talk about music, listen to music all the time, and he knew I played, and he talked about his grandfather's guitar that he had under his bed, and he started telling me about this guitar. It was had F holes, kind of small. I said, well, what is the name on the headstock up there? And he said, Kalamazoo. I was like, oh. So Kalamazoo is originally what Gibson guitar was called before it was called Gibson guitars. They were Kalamazoo, made in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I do believe that old instruments, old houses, they all have like some kind of energy in it. They have stuff in them, you know. I don't know. Inanimate objects can have information if you feel it, you know. I'm just an intuitive person that way. Maybe it's a little too new age. I don't know, but that's the way I feel, like, especially with old instruments. I said, man, would you bring that Kalamazoo in? And I'll put new strings on it. And I'll fix it up, and I'll play it. Record something for you just so you can hear your grandfather's guitar again. So he did, and I fixed it up, put new strings, and I shit you not, John, it was like the first thing I played. And look, I'm not a finger picker at all. I mean, I'm really not. And especially at the time, I was more of a strummer. But something happened, and this is the first thing I played, is this little riff. I don't know where it came from. At the time, it was unlike me. like me, really. All is home up Chiquita slums. Still feel the sun when the day is done. My bones are wet, they sweat when I squeeze. My head in my hand, waiting for a breeze. I swallow my pills by the windowsill, trying to find the words for the way I feel. The telephone has got an ugly tone. Savages and spiders, they eat their own. I'm like a dog, I don't like to bark. Just a muddy old crow, I can't find the ark. My feet are muddy, I guess I suppose I'll put them under the water hose. Sometimes I lose all humility. Sometimes I can't find what's in front of me. Sometimes the song finds a hole in the bag. Sometimes the summer, Lord, it's just a drag. I watched it fall. I heard the radio bleeding through the walls. I couldn't remember what dichotomy meant. Then something happened, something clicked. I found my woman reading in her chair, and we made love out of despair. I found my woman in a chair, we made love out of despair. Sometimes I lose all humility. Sometimes I can't find what's in front of me. Sometimes a song finds a hole in the bay. Sometimes the summer, it's just a drag. Sometimes the summer, Lord, it's just a drag.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That guitar sounds great.
Yeah, that sounds nice, huh? Right on. That's a good one.
So what have you been listening to lately?
You know what I've been listening to? I haven't been listening to a lot of music, but I've been listening to a lot of Ram Dass.
Oh, yeah.
Talks. Yeah, I've been listening to a lot of that. There's a podcast that run by his, I don't know, Be Here Now organization that they just play his old talks and lectures and stuff. And I love that stuff. I've been listening to a lot of that on my bike rides.
Yeah, I went to a workshop with that guy one time.
Really?
Yeah, here in Austin. He came through Austin. It was very nice, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of evened me out a little bit.
Cool. Yeah, I'm loving it, man. It's blowing my mind a little bit.
I've been following, you know, various Buddhist teachings for years and years. I'm not a very good Buddhist. I don't go sit with a sangha or anything like that, but
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of podcasts and things. There's a guy named Brad Warner who used to be the member of a punk rock band, and now he's a Buddhist teacher, and he's on YouTube. You know, he has a constant stream of things on YouTube.
Okay.
Listen to him sometimes.
Yeah, I'll check that out. Yeah, I've always I mean, ever since Book People, I worked there, you know, that was we had the whole Well, in the Brody Oak store, you know, we had the middle of the store was the Buddhist Eastern philosophy section. There was a big Buddha in the middle.
I remember.
Remember that? So the funniest thing is Jimmy Dale used to come in all the time.
Right.
It's before I knew him. He didn't know who I was, but he would come in. I mean, the guy came in all the time. He's like, could you tell me where your Eastern philosophy section is? I'm like, yeah, man. It's right in the middle of the store. Come on, I'll show. But he could never remember. It always blew my mind.
Those guys have a weekly meditation thing that they do. They're in a Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I think.
Really? Yeah. I knew he was pretty serious, music, there's an Usher record I just got in the mail that I'm going to listen to. I'm always listening to Tom Waits. That's always in there. Vic Chestnut is one of my favorites that I listen to on a regular basis. There's a lot of playlists out there. I listen to a lot of playlists that my friends make on Spotify. That's like the closest thing to trading comp tapes like we used to do.
Yeah.
Or comp CDs, that you have a friend who makes, or you can make a playlist with someone else. You can collaborate. You can even listen to things together with people on Spotify now, which is a really cool thing that you can do. It's the next best thing to being there. So.
Yeah, people are starting to jam a lot online. I think people are watching movies together too.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. I mean, it's better to be with somebody. Actually physically.
It's a good way to discover music that never would have known about otherwise. Just see what other people listen to.
Yeah, exactly. That's a friend of mine. He's a DJ out of Houston, Clint Broussard. He's got a show on KPFT called Blues and Hi-Fi.
Oh, my old neighborhood. I used to work there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you might even know him, but yeah, I love that station. That station meant a lot to me. When I lived out in that neighborhood in the suburbs of Houston, I could barely get that station on the dial. It was a little staticky.
What years was that?
That was probably, mid-80s, early mid-80s.
Yeah, okay, after my time. I was there in the very early days after the Klan bombed us off the air a couple of times.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I've heard those stories.
We had some great music. Yeah, we had Shiva's Headband come on and do live jams with Spencer.
Right on. Yeah, that's the first time I heard punk rock was on that station out in the suburbs. I dialed it in. There'd be punk rock shows and blues. I mean, I had never really heard real blues music. I remember hearing Taj Mahal on Juneteenth one time. I didn't know what Juneteenth was when I was a kid. I was dial it in, and it was a live simulcast of Taj Mahal somewhere in Houston. KPFT was broadcasting it, and it was a Juneteenth concert. And, so I looked up, and what's Juneteenth, and my encyclopedias that we had. and heard Taj Mahal, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. And the blues shows on there, I'd never heard anything like that. So KPFT is a special radio station to me. And so anyway, but Clint sent me a playlist yesterday, like a 6-hour playlist. I met this girl during COVID, a young woman online. She was a fan, but we just started talking about music, and her and her sister live in Virginia. I've never met these people in person. I don't even, but they're sweet girls and they're way into music. And so we have worked on a playlist for the last 18 months. It's like a 20-hour playlist at this point, because we're just trying to stump each other, by sending songs. And when we send a song, we add it to the playlist.
It sounds like what John and I are doing to each other. We have a weekly,
yeah,
a weekly radio show, and John and I try to out weird each other. And
we have these big collections of music it's stuff that nobody plays. I mean, you're not gonna hear it anywhere else, so we
could be, there's
Internet
a reason for that
every week.
Do y'all know Ted Gioia?
I don't think so.
No.
Yeah,
I
look, Yeah, look him up. He's living in Austin now, a music writer. Really great.
How's his last name spelled?
Yeah, let me get that for you. I heard him give a lecture, G-I-O-I-A. G-I-O-I-A. Yeah, really great. I follow his Twitter and his Substack. He's got a Substack.
Cool.
Yeah, music writer mostly. Classical and jazz is mostly what he writes about. But a historian and critic, you know. But, yeah, he might be a good guy for your podcast. He's brilliant. Brilliant guy. I don't remember what I was talking about. But, he talked about the importance of having your own physical music collection. You know, it's important because a lot of the streaming sites, you know, you probably know as well as I, there's stuff that's just not on there. It's out of print. Nobody cares about it. It's been forgotten.
Yeah,
that's... Now we're all Harry Smiths now. We have to preserve all of that collection of stuff that's not going to show up in the streaming world ever. Yeah.
That's why I kept all this stuff right over here on the wall there. That's like about a third of what there is. My wife is ready to leave me and move in with my record collection.
I will say, in the streaming world, if you can't find it anywhere else, you might find it on YouTube.
Yeah,
YouTube ton of stuff on there that's true. Just out of print.
That is true. YouTube is good that way. Yeah.
Well, Kev, thanks. I guess our hour is about up here.
All right. And
this has been fantastic.
Yeah, man, it was great talking to y'all.
We'll have to have
Let's do it again.
We do a live show on Tuesday, on Thursday evenings, and we'll have to have you by sometime.
Oh yeah, definitely love to. Yeah,
that'd be great. We'll follow up with you.
I'll ride my bike over.
All right. Hey, that's great. I didn't know you rode a bike.
Yeah,
I ride a bike in your turf. You know, in your neighborhood sometimes.
Okay, well, let me know when you come by. I got a flat tire right now. I went on some trails yesterday, and I think I broke my toe and got a flat tire, but it was fun as hell.
Well, that sounds like fun to me.
Well, thanks again, and we'll see you soon, man.
Okay, man. Love
Stay
y'all.
Safe.
Love you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.